Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by 100 Bogart Street. Do you need a conference room for your next meeting? Learn more by visiting 100bogart.com. Hey, this is Hannah, HRN's program manager. It's HRN's 10th anniversary and now our summer fun drive. So show your support for independent, revolutionary, entertaining food radio by becoming a monthly recurring donor. HRN is powered by a passionate community of thoughtful eaters, and we need each and every one of you to show your support so that we can keep bringing you your favorite food podcasts. It takes a village, and every dollar donated, every listener tuning in is essential to our continued success. So set up a donation for $10 every month. You'll show us that you want to be a part of a bright future for HRN. And you'll get one of our brand new limited edition Pizza Pocket t-shirts. So snag your new favorite tee and show us some love, all for the price of about two fancy lattes each month. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate today. And thank you.
Good morning. My co-host here, Patrick Martins, I think you were an orchestra leader in a past life.
My father's a conductor.
All right. So is that what the inspiration was for our intro music?
I think it was more the orchestral music was the inspiration for the conducting.
Ah, okay. Well, chicken or the egg. Either way. It is Thursday, June 20th. I'm Emily Pearson, and I'm here with my co-host, Patrick Martins.
Good Thanks morning. For having me.
Oh, my pleasure, my pleasure. And Eric Koss of the Alameda Sun newspaper in California. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Hi, everyone.
Covering national news stories through the lens of Alameda.
All That's day, me. Every day, every Thursday in circulation.
Every Thursday.
Exactly. Least, yeah. Well, this is the main course OG, and our guests for the weekly grill are Sam and Donna Edwards, longtime friends of ours, very longtime friends of Patrick's.
Since 1926.
Oh, you've been alive since 1926?
No, but who knows? I mean, that's how long that business is. That family is a part of third generation Cure Master family.
That family is the Edwards family of Edwards Virginia Smokehouse in Surrey, Virginia. And you guys are in town for the Fancy Food Show and for...
Where he's a Hall of Fame member.
What does that entail?
I'm old.
You spend a lot
Stick
of...
around long enough.
What do you mean?
Later.
You're in the Fancy Food Hall of Fame?
Yes.
Do you get a bust?
No.
You get a little
I got
plaque.
A plaque.
They basically introduced, you know, we're one of the first Virginia family-based businesses to consistently rent a stand at the Fancy Food Show. And now, 40 years later, whatever it is, like, Virginia has a whole wing.
So you are their biggest donor, so to speak.
Yeah.
You've paid in as the fancy food prices have risen for a stand. No, that's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because remember, Sam sold peanuts too and makes his own, you know, line of peanuts. So he wasn't just representing his ham, bacon, sausage. I mean, he carried a lot of different.
And yeah, now the Fancy Virginia Food Show made. I know is not just by country, but in the U.S. it's done by region and
yeah.
by state.
Yes. And Virginia was one of the ones, Virginia, California, Vermont, Wisconsin. They were probably the big four in the beginning. And I'm not sure how many states. There's quite a few though, that are represented by region.
That's really cool. I think that's fantastic. And that you were the leaders in sort of narrowing the scope of finding the local sources, so to speak.
Well, then he went from Fancy Food Show, which I think maybe had was more interesting 30, 40 years ago, and now he's progressively moved towards the Good Food Awards, you know, and the very sustainable angle of that. So, you know, yeah, Sam's always been on the cutting edge. He's one of the first businesses, old school Southern businesses, to launch a vibrant mail order campaign direct to consumer. You know, he was like way early in that trend. getting ham, bacon, sausage to anyone in the country, anyone through the South, just one click away.
So for those of you who are listening who want to attend, the Fancy Food Show is Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday of this week. And I think it's open to the public on the last day.
Does that happen anymore? I haven't heard that part. I do. If you have a food business with a business card, you can get in. I think it's $50.
Cool. Yep. Jacob Javits Center.
You eat. Basically, you eat a meal.
Basically, if you're hot this weekend, you need air conditioning and food, go to the Fancy Food Show. It's always delicious. All right, we are going to jump into the weekly based and our round robin question. Fast paced in here. Oh, thank you, Jeet, for my music. Name the cooking tool that has played the biggest role in your life or career thus far.
Or curing tool.
The smokehouse. Is that considered a tool?
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, that is what we're known for. And we smoke, we cook. Yeah.
The smokehouse. What kind of wood? Hickory?
Hickory. We've tried. We use hickory, but we've used oak, apple, pecan.
Do you know the source of the wood exactly? Like which forest it comes from?
By tree, actually. We track by tree.
That's pretty cool.
No, I'm kidding. No. We have relationships with forestry services that certain times of the year they cut hickory. And they know
to call you first?
They know to call.
That's pretty cool. Donna, what's yours?
Sam.
Oh, good answer. Nice. You're just a tool.
He is a tool.
In her repertoire.
I don't know where to go with that.
With a lot of knowledge.
I like the trivet, which can also be used as a bacon press.
I'm going to go with a knife. Just a knife.
A knife?
Yeah. You can utilize it for everything.
Is this a surprise question for you? You wrote this question.
I know.
That's what you came prepared for?
Last week I said tongs. This week I'm going to go with a knife.
Last week I went with bacon press.
I'm going to go back. My fingers. You don't really need anything else. No?
Fingers?
That doesn't work for you?
Ethiopian cuisine.
All right. Eric?
Are you going to say a spoon again, yeah. Eric?
No, I came up with another one. I'm going with the cast iron skillet, super versatile, and as I understand it, one of the few ways you can actually get iron in your diet.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, you actually scrape off little molecules. I thought you're not supposed to scrape cast iron skillets too much.
You're supposed to kind of leave all that grease and dirt just leave it in the pan.
I don't know. It happens just automatically.
I still wash it. Come on. Do you wash your cast iron skillet?
Not with detergent. I just rinse it with hot water use like a scrubby thing.
Mm-hmm. I do more of a wipe out and a rinse. You're not supposed to use much soap.
Right.
I don't know. Fine. All right, moving on.
That was our first question of the weekly base.
The best answers are Smokehouse and Sam. For the win. Okay, so hashtag Meat Free Mondays just celebrated its 10th birthday, and it turns out, I did not know this, it's not just a hashtag, but a full-fledged nonprofit campaign led by Paul McCartney. Launched in 2009, the organization is celebrating its 10th birthday this month and has spent the last decade, quote, encouraging people to help slow climate change, conserve precious natural resources, and improve their health by having at least one plant-based day each week. What do you think?
Well, isn't it sort of just like having the opposite of Meatball Day or whatever, but it happens every week? It's like a promotional tool for vegetables.
Well, yeah, exactly.
I didn't know there was Meatball Day.
Yeah, we talked about it on the show.
That was my first Meatball Day, actually. Yeah, we discussed it. I mean,
it's certainly better than his last campaign, which was Don't Eat Meat. I mean, good luck with that one, Paul. And also, how come the Beatles, I mean, for how many songs they've written, they have a low percentage that are very, very good. You're supposed to say you love the Beatles, but I mean, they wrote 5 trillion songs and they have like 3 good ones. I like a band that wrote 8 songs and 6 of them are amazing.
What's that have to do with Meatless Mondays?
I don't think that's a popular viewpoint, but...
You know who the best rapper is by far is Biggie Smalls, because he only did 2 albums and they were both great.
And then he
died. Well, unfortunately, okay, but it means, you don't want to overproduce.
All right, well, this Meatless Mondays thing is... getting a lot of celebrity traction. I saw the video made by Tom Hanks and his wife Rita Wilson, and I think it's not a huge ask to get people behind having, one day where you eat lighter, cleaner, without meat. And I think at least they're not saying meat-free
weeks.
What
do you think, Sam, about the meat vegetarian?
don't tell anybody, but I had an Impossible Burger last night for dinner. So
and
that was my attempt to be meatless for
that
a
was
day.
Your meat free Wednesday.
Yeah,
eating a hamburger.
It was okay.
Very good.
Not
just
beef.
Okay.
Not beef.
What texture or taste?
Texture was pretty close. The taste was a little different.
Would you have noticed? Would you have known you were in a barbecue? You were eating three cheeseburgers. You'd be like, wait a second.
Yeah, no, I would have noticed.
There's Impossible Burger, and the other one is
Beyond Meat. I think they own the Impossible Burger.
Oh, really? I thought there were two companies coming out.
I think
it's
there might be another one, but I think Beyond makes the Impossible Burger. And I did read that they're having a shortage. They're that popular right now that they're having a shortage.
I think if they put more Worcestershire sauce on the one I had last night, it would taste more like a
burger. If you just dump a bunch of condiments, it makes everything better.
I like it. This is actually a huge loss for the vegetarian movement because, you know, it's evolved. What they should have been promoting all along from the early 60s or whenever they started is less meat, higher quality meat, humanely raised meat. Because as we know, the heritage breed does not fall into this industrial complex stereotypes, this and that. So they went from asking for 7 days to asking for one. So, you know, with that kind of tail between your legs, I accept. I support meatless Mondays.
All right. He now likes the Beatles. So we were very sad. Eric. Go ahead.
I just wanted to point out that the Beatles have a song called Piggies. I don't know if you know it. It's kind of like a political allegory, but that's actually the title, Piggies.
And the pigs are let free to roam the countryside in northern England? Is that what it's about?
No, I think they just kind of like go forward to slaughter or whatever because they're they're representing politicians.
That's interesting.
That was not one of the Beatles hits that Patrick was referring to.
Actually, that's a good
one.
I like
the White Album or something. Sorry.
So I'm just going to segue a little here. We were sad to hear that Molly O'Neill passed away this Sunday after a long and public battle with cancer. Molly was a food journalist born into a baseball family, actually, the sister of Paul O'Neill of the Yankees, who wrote for the New York Times' Sunday Magazine and the Style section from 1990 to 2000. I know, Patrick, I think you have a story about Molly you wanted to share, but is there a story you guys have about Molly or another old titan of the food journalism industry, someone that's resonated with you?
Sam?
Mr. Apple came down to Surrey. I wasn't really familiar with him until after he did the interview. And, of course, he wrote for the New York Times, but he also was a journalist for... I call it serious journalism, but it was World War II, Vietnam War, so forth. And then he kind of took his hobby on of cooking, started writing about food across the country, and very unpretentious, loved his wife. I believe her name was Rose. Both of them came by for a visit. But I've actually got one of his books on my bookstand, waiting to be finished.
R.W. Apple? What was the R.W. for?
Don't know. I called him Mr. Apple.
He was a big guy.
Yep. Loved to eat.
And so he came down, you got a tour of the plant?
Yes. Came through the smokehouses.
Did he write about you?
Yes.
Interesting. Would you say that was the article that introduced you to the North and to New York City?
No.
Nope. How did people first learn about you? Was it just through the hams themselves or the sausage or bacon appearing in stores like Zabar's?
In New York?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we started coming to the food show in 1983. So that was the big introduction. But before that, we were already selling some folks in New York.
But was there a particular journalist that kind of, I don't know, elevated your name or brought it to the people a little bit more?
We've been real fortunate to have fairly wide coverage in newspapers and magazines across the country, food magazines related. That one of the first articles we had was right after Don and I got married, and or the Tennessean, I believe it was. And she, they're interviewing her while I'm in the booth. And next thing I know, she's up on a ladder, or the guy's up on a ladder taking a picture of Donna holding one of her hams. And on the front page of the food section, Tennessean is the Donna, her maiden name was Wallace, the Donna Wallace Ham Company.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So not only did she get the publicity for the Edwards Ham, she changed the name of the company.
You really took advantage.
All in the midst of one interview and photo shoot. Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
Well, I will say, yeah. Molly O'Neill, she did, you know, getting back to the question, she came up with the term godfather of American poultry for Frank Rees. So when Slow Food put Frank on the map, she flew to Lindsberg to meet with them and went into his kitchen and cooked his chicken and all that stuff. So, you know, she was one of those people that really went out there. And she also introduced me to Pete Wells, who was becoming the editor of the food section. And so a bunch of people went. I actually sat with next to Betty Fussell, you know, that old lady, great lady, written so many books. I mean, she had, I think, now 85 or whatever, but she's been such an amazing person. And Pete asked us all these questions about what we did and informed him. You know, I have to say, I don't know whatever came of that meeting, because certainly I've never seen an article on global warming or anything like that in the food section. But, you know, we talked about serious things. I told him about a radio station. He's like, yeah, whatever.
I don't understand how you go from being an editor who's a public face to being a restaurant critic. It's like he went the wrong way.
Well, look at Frank Bruni.
But the whole idea was that you were never supposed to know what the critic looked like.
Oh, yeah. He was the first one where you kind of did.
Yeah. Anyway.
Well, no, she was great. And Paul O'Neill, one of the best right fielders. Reggie Jackson,
you should have
Paul
worn
O'Neill.
His shirt today in honor of
he's
of
pro-Trump. He was one of, like, the one Yankee who went down to see Trump. Sorry.
Moving on. Deviating from a political conversation here. So next up, Modern Farmer reported on 7 smokable plants you can grow that are not marijuana, including mullein, skullcap, coltsfoot, mugwort, uva urshi, mint, and sage. Really, this is just my excuse to talk about CBD, pot, and pork. Sam, is there a future?
I've heard that there's a company in Seattle, I believe it was, that tried that. I don't know how it came out, how it tasted, how expensive it ultimately ended up being, but I haven't heard the results.
You're not doing CBD Suriano pre-sliced?
Not yet. It's not in Virginia anyway.
Or smoking it with weed instead of just regular hickory wood. No, but I mean, can you
make that sage smoked finished hams?
Well, we use sage as an ingredient in our sausage, but we haven't used it for smoking yet.
Oh my God, that sausage is so good. It's so good. The hickory one. We're making 1,000 pounds of it at Heritage. But I think Edward's sausage might be the best in show, which is crazy because we love the Suriano, but the sausage is like, wow.
Do you fire up some sausage for the Fancy Food Show?
No.
No?
Just the Suriano this year.
Oh.
And we'll have the product will be there, but...
But only tastes of the Suriano.
Yes.
Fantastic.
Well, I mean, do you make new stuff? Like if someone says, hey, do this CBD, I'll pay you $50,000. Would you go into the smokehouse, figure it out, say how I'm going to soak it, produce the product, slice it, sell it to them?
To my knowledge, the FDA hasn't, or the Virginia Department of Agriculture has not allowed that to be done yet. And I think the FDA
CBD
is still
bacon
working on it. Yeah.
Coming later.
Yeah, CBD later bacon. I could definitely see that being in the next wave. I think the way the chocolates have happened and gummies and people putting it in like matcha tea and, you know, New York has sort of had to pull back on
pretty
that a little
everything
bit because it's not FDA regulated. And so there's been a question about all of that. But I could see that happening, especially out of California, some local ranchers.
Yeah. Right. We've got tea and all kinds of other food products going.
I'm going to stay in Alameda for 2 days. I don't know if that's a news story, but I will be there
fun
in a couple of weeks. So.
Oh, wow. Yeah, you got to look me up, man.
We're staying with Brian, actually. So the Honey Baked Ham Company just launched an online merchandise shop, and to celebrate, made a hammock that looks exactly like a honey baked ham, and it wraps around your body, putting you in what one writer calls a flesh cocoon. Donna, why didn't you edit that out when you were being the censor? Sam, are you making a wigwam mock or a surmock? It seems to me that everyone is merch obsessed, especially at trade shows. Are you giving away free stuff at Fancy Food? And what merch does Edwards produce?
We're working on hickory smoke cologne. We think it's going to work very
Stop.
Well.
Stop. No, he's not.
Oh, I thought he was serious for a second. I was totally, I took the bait. I took the bait.
But, you know, for years, because when you work in a smokehouse, it permeates your clothes, your hair, everything. So, and after a while, you just lose that smell, in a sense, that you smell like that. I know when I was growing up, my sister always thought my dad's cologne was hickory smoke because he always smelled like that. And, no, there's been some talk about, I wonder if that would work.
What do you make? You make hats?
Oh, yeah. Hats, aprons, T-shirts.
And you have an Old Country store that sells hundreds of little things, but most of those are Virginia-made, not necessarily made by you guys.
Right.
So you support local Virginia businesses.
Yeah, we focus on the Virginia.
Donna, can you describe the store to us?
Manufacturers.
Like what one would find when they go to your country store?
Well, we have sandwiches to go. Outdoor picnic tables, so you can come in, get something to eat, go outside. As far as hams, bacon, sausage, other Virginia specialties.
Yeah, but you sell little things like trivets and pot holders and some of that stuff?
Yeah, not so much. We've kind of gone back to the basics of what we do and what Edwards stands for as right, quality right. products.
So I know that the town of Surrey is just 300 people, as you said, but you guys sit right on the river by the ferry. So do you have quite a lot? Do a lot of people pass through? I've never been. How does that work?
We are along the road that people go into Jamestown and Williamsburg, tourists coming off 95 Route 40, coming to Surrey, going across the ferry, landing in Jamestown. So we do pick up some of the tourist trade coming by, and. For years, we've taken tours of the smokehouse, and that was part of the attraction, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, one thing about the fire is that you don't have to deal with the USDA in your own plant anymore. That's one good thing. But how do you interact with the USDA and the United States Department of Agriculture, Sam? I mean, I know you have a lot to say about the subject.
Well, the USDA is can be very helpful, and they serve a purpose, but they also, especially when it comes to dry cured meats, there's a lot that most inspectors don't know about. And we are having to constantly educate them about the safety side, food safety side of dry cured meats.
Like, give an example.
Well, I mean, this is a product that's been made for 5,000 years, or at least trackable back 5,000 years to the Chinese. So we're basically following the same techniques, low water activity. You have a salt content that's high enough that its antimicrobial affects not only the flavor profile, but the food safety side. So there's been science that's been done to prove that it's safe to eat. I just had a conversation last week with an inspector. The science that I provided to them was from Italy, Spain, and the U.S. That he said, well, you just got to throw out that science from Italy and Spain because that's not American. I went, science is science. I mean, why not? Why can't you use the science from other avenues? Anyway, they all agree, the scientists do anyway, that the food is safe to eat. So because we're such a narrow, narrow niche in the meat world, they don't have a cubbyhole to put us in. So
is that for prosciutto you're talking about, or also for your ham and sausage?
The prosciutto, the dry cured, well, I mean, we're doing dry cured lamb. That was a stumbling block for us just recently. We were working on a dry cured lamb, and they just couldn't grasp the concept.
Because it's not something that people are used to seeing. It's not commonplace.
Correct. They were trying to say that just because it's okay in pork and beef, it's not okay in lamb.
And why not?
The scientists say it's species doesn't matter.
Right.
It's water activity and the antimicrobial, like salt.
Now, you're a member of the Country Ham Association, right?
Correct.
And they have an annual meeting, and they have give out awards and in all these different categories, and they do not even have a category for long-aged hams.
Correct.
I mean, that is the craziest thing to me. Benton, Broadbent. You know, all these guys, Volpe, you know, anyone who's a member of that organization who cures over a year, of course, it's a different product. It's like prosciutto. The other one is a thick breakfast ham in a way. Like, I can't believe they've never tactically just added an award, but the big guys don't cure for that long.
Well, so, and historically, it's not a Southern tradition. You know, in your family, it is, but historically, in terms of the larger...
In the 16, 17, 1800s, that was common, but as people try to get the cost of their product down, because he who had the cheapest price in the grocery stores won the battle of market share, so how do you cheapen it? You don't age it as long, and...
You put it out faster,
right? So we've kind of stuck with the longer age product because that's kind of the niche that works for us in restaurant, especially the restaurant trade. The chefs seem to appreciate it more.
Absolutely, and for chefs, I know that the fact that you're doing the work in your signature style with your process, and that they're buying this completed, perfect age product, you know, a lot of chefs these days make their own salami, but they don't make their own prosciutto. They leave that to craftsmen like you. Hey.
It's true. Sorry. Jeez. I meant to do this one.
Thank you. On that note, my co-host Patrick.
Sorry, I'm new to the soundboard. Hey, let's do a quick cut to the top Alameda Sun story. What's the top news story today?
Okay, all right. So I got to give you some background here. Now, I you guys are probably familiar with the fact that California is suffering from wildfires, and that during this season, and that PG&E, our primary power company out here, is occasionally shutting down areas so that they don't potentially spark another fire. Now, you would think that Alameda, the island city of approximately 80,000 people in the middle of San Francisco Bay, would be immune to a wildfire, which typically happens way out there in the woods. We're a pretty urban little city. And that this wouldn't be affecting us. And another thing that we have, our ace in the hole, is Alameda has its own power company since 1887 or something like that. We've actually invested in a municipal power plant and power of our own under a company called Alameda Municipal Power. So residents here might have the idea that we're immune to anything that's happening to PG&E, but it just so happens that we have to use PG&E's grid to access our sources of power, and PG&E at any time could potentially shut down our entire city if they feel like it, and AMP, as we call our local company for short, doesn't exactly know when or how PG&E is going to impact us, and they are trying to find out. So they're telling residents here in Alameda to be ready for an outage in case it should happen.
So hospitals getting the generators ready. I mean, yeah, a lot of stuff relies on the grid. Holy cow.
Yeah, and 80,000 people and a bunch of services, our fire department, police department, everything else.
What's the message here? Don't buy an electric car?
I don't know. Just be ready. You know, you always got to be prepared with some kind of an emergency kit, both for
you have a go bag
out here, and I do. I actually have an earthquake bag. That would.
I think that's something that New Yorkers really don't have in the same way that Californians do.
Virginians just have like a gun closet.
do you have a cellar? I think, yeah, when people are ready for tornadoes, people are ready for earthquakes.
They shoot it down. All the Virginians shoot right at the base of the tornado, and they'll basically disarm it. Speaking of taking things down, how do you guys feel about the removing of cultural icon landmarks, busts, faces, statues throughout the throughout the South? We just had Nancy Newsom here, and she said she avidly disagrees with taking down these kind of landmarks, cultural icons.
Well, I certainly understand those who want to have it removed. Kind of makes sense. But at the same time, it is our history. And you know, you'd hate to think that 100 years from now, when all of that's gone, if it were to be gone, that clearly is that history ever going to be lost in 500 years, 300 years? Who knows? But I know plenty of folks that said, well, if you're going to take them down, you can move them to my house. I'll
take them. opening a museum.
They're a museum, I was just going to say.
A museum is fine. Yeah.
Oh, that's good. Is that what they're going to do?
That's the talk.
Yeah. I thought it was.
Which state would own it? Like, oh, brother, that would be tough. Oh, I guess one in each state.
Yeah.
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 What is that? The Museum of Censorship? It just becomes the museum of everything that people didn't want to have publicly displayed anymore, but it's still a part of history.
You're like,
you go to this one building to see it.
Welcome to the Jefferson Davis Dining Room. How can we help you? Oh, please, you.
Right.
Please sit over there. No, just kidding. That was a joke. But how would you describe Virginia's role? That was just for ratings. Oh, Donna, how do you feel about it?
About what?
The landmarks and the southern things.
I think it's very personal.
Yeah, yeah.
You see people on both sides of the fence that are, you know, their personal views, you can't disagree or agree when you have it that personal.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah. You can't change someone's mind of who they are.
No, you can't. Mm-hmm. So I think, I think the museums is definitely an avenue that could be probably reached by both parties. But again, it's a personal issue.
Well, that's interesting. I'm trying to get people to change their minds all the time. It's crazy. It's tiring. No one likes me.
You know,
so
I don't think you can erase half of what happened in the Civil War. I mean, history is history. It's got to be recorded someplace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, look at the Germans. I mean, Berlin and all Germany is covered with monuments everywhere, you know.
Well, no.
Well, I mean, I, by the way, got very mad at Volkswagen for already trying to do PR again for their new VW bus. I'm like, take another 10 years off, guys. You committed too big a crime. But back to the question, how would you describe Virginia's role in Southern culture?
Or Southern food culture.
Southern food culture, yeah.
Well, again, where we live, we're 4 miles from Jamestown. So quite a bit of the food culture, that was the center of the universe for so many years. And a lot of it came from what the settlers brought from England, but we also have the American Indian that contributed to that food culture. I mean, you know, it took hundreds of years to expand from that region. So a lot of the food, you know, I'm in the meat world. So Virginia ham is one of the first exports out of this, the new world. Hmm. So for us, that's one of the icons for this region. As far as how do we stack in the South, I mean, there's a lot of, you get down to New Orleans, Charleston, Savannah, Atlanta. I mean, there's a lot of culture there that's a mix of U.S., French, African-American, or African. So, yeah, we're kind of a hodgepodge.
And is the Mason-Dixon line a real line culturally? I mean,
well, it was established during the Civil War, but it's you can't say that line it has any impact at all today other than historical.
Because Alexandria, Virginia, Northern Virginia is what makes people, I think, not think of Virginia so much as a southern state.
Yeah, everything north of Fredericksburg or even Richmond, for that matter, is D.C. It's moving down this way. And basically,
half your state is D.C.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
It's a totally different mindset from, like I say, Manassas and that region out to Roanoke, Virginia, which is 4 or 5 hours away. Totally different mindset.
Mm.
Yep.
Hmm. Very interesting. So we have two more quick questions.
Yeah, and then we're going to take a quick break. But before that, we know a name can make or break a product. How do you do it? How much work goes into naming a new product? I hear from this earlier story, maybe your wife has something to do with it. You know, she name drops herself in, but... No, Wallace, remember? Back in the Tennessean. Oh,
that was an editor of a newspaper.
All right. Well, you maybe just looked prettier with the ham.
That was a fact.
No, but how do you name products?
Well, in the case of one of the more famous products we developed in the last 10 years was the Suriano. That started out as tongue-in-cheek. I know Patrick's heard the story. I'm pretty sure you have too. Union Square Cafe, Carmen, the chef over there, I was trying to explain to them what the Suriano was. It's not like a regular country ham that you slice thicker and fry, but more like a prosciutto style. And tongue-in-cheek, I said, yeah, we were going to call it the Suriano. So he kind of gets the concept of the European-style ham. Mm-hmm. Unbeknownst to me, he puts it on the menu as Suriano, and it kind of stuck. And because people watch what they do, other chefs do, then they started calling and asking for the Suriano ham for their menu.
It's brilliant.
Yeah, right.
I mean, it is. Suriano. He's from Surrey. I mean, it's gold.
Right. We did a hog jowls are the same thing as guanciale, just as a joke. We started calling it jowl chale. Not many people got that joke.
I like that one, though.
Well, you know, I had a lumber yard for a while, and I named it We're Lumber One. And then I changed it to Chairman of the Boards. So,
and then they went out of business on day two.
It was a terrible move. So, and Sam, right before we go to break, and Donna, what's your favorite way that you've seen your ham, bacon, and sausage offered on the menu? I mean, your food is an institution in Southern diners, high-end restaurants, hole-in-the-wall, but I mean, it's everywhere. And what is also amazing about it is they don't do anything. Like, I went to Husk, and all the chef did was grill up Sam's sausages and place it on a plate with, like, some mashed potatoes. That was enough. He didn't need to do anything.
Because he said that nothing needed to be done to it. It was delicious the way it was.
It's a different concept. Yeah. In the North, the chef would be like, I grinded it, I separated the skin, I did all this, and it wouldn't be an Edward sausage.
And I used one dot in my consommé, yeah.
So what's the most creative way you've seen your food served? Or not creative?
Well, yeah, not creative. Down our way, people will take Virginia ham with Serrano ham and just put a crab cake on top of it. So when you cut through the crab cake, you're eating a little bit of the ham at the same time. Mm. Personally, I like to see a well-aged country ham in an Eggs Benedict. You know, so many places you get that Canadian bacon on it that's just not quite as, doesn't have as much oomph. If you eat it with a Virginia ham or Serrano ham, the flavor profile uniquely changes the product.
Surf and turf.
Awesome. I actually just like very simple. I like a great baguette or a good piece of bread with like a freshly sliced, thin slice, a few layers.
You know,
I like
to go.
You know, yes,
a good
I like a good jambon beurre. Yes, we like the one that our friends at Bread First do in D.C. But if I'm thinking about Suriano and prosciutto, I like to have it just super simple.
Very good. All right, nothing better than a slice. We're going to take a break and come back with three interesting questions for our guest, Sam Edwards.
This episode is brought to you by 100 Bogart, a new building in Bushwick, Brooklyn that provides offices, co-working, event spaces, and a brand new podcast recording room. Have you been dreaming of starting your very own podcast in Brooklyn? You can now rent space in 100 Bogart's custom-built podcast room to record interviews, voiceover, and commentary. The room is fitted out with two microphones, mixing board, and a MacBook Pro running Pro Tools. You can rent the space by the hour, and a rental of an hour or more includes a 100 Bogart co-working pass. That means complimentary coffee, tea, and access to your own desk for the rest of the day. So what are you waiting for? Get started on your next audio project. 100 Bogart has the space and amenities you need to kickstart your podcast. Learn more at 100bogart.com or call their team at 718-362-3539.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Korsha Wilson, and I'm the host of A Hungry Society here on HRN. A Hungry Society focuses on highlighting dope people doing amazing work in food, and we talk about how we can make the culinary world a more diverse and inclusive space. You can join the conversation by checking out A Hungry Society wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
All right, and we're back. This is the Main Course OG, broadcasting live on Heritage Radio Network from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I am here in studio with my co-host Patrick Martins and our very special guests Sam and Donna Edwards of Edwards Virginia Smokehouse. So Sam, as our listeners may or may not know, your smokehouse suffered a devastating fire back in January 2016, and you've been tirelessly battling with your insurance company and working to rebuild. Can you discuss the state of the insurance suit and the rebuild?
We're going to the Virginia Supreme Court to get a ruling September the 9th, and we should have an answer by November. So by this time next year, we should be concluded with the whole process.
Finally,
4.5 years.
And basically the rub here is that to get your business, they said, oh, pay this amount of insurance and you'll get this amount of coverage, which is enough for you to be able to rebuild and reopen at your current size. And then when the shit hit the fan, you realize that they were not giving you enough to rebuild.
That's a pretty good summation. Selective Insurance in Middle Peninsula brokers, we felt like, just didn't handle that whole process well. But I can't talk about it too much because we're still in court.
And the rebuild, I mean, what's your vision of the rebuild? What would be your ideal rebuild like right now?
Well, we've already got it drawn out. Same square footage, but obviously lined. Everything is designed better because the plant we had before the fire was built over, started in 1940s. Mm-hmm. So there was a hodgepodge of build rooms that would add it on. So it would be more efficient, but at the same time, we've saved back, and we had some equipment that was stored in another warehouse that we'll be able to use, hopefully, to kind of reestablish that good terroir we had prior to the fire.
That's awesome. So, well, we look forward to, fingers crossed for good news in September. So it has been 2.5 years or more since you've had your own smokehouse, and yet you've consistently made your products available to your customers. We have a Suriano sitting in the room. We carry it at Heritage. Tell us about the first post-fire vintage of the Suriano.
Yeah, so the first vintage came out this past spring. It should have been a year earlier, but crazy enough, one of the friends of ours in the country ham industry that we were working with, his plant burned too in 2017.
That was in Kentucky.
Yeah. So we had to start all over again. So we've been working with smokehouses in Kentucky, Tennessee, and North Carolina. And even though they're following our recipe the best they can to the letter, there's, because of their terroir, there's going to be a little bit of a difference. It's not going to be exactly the same, but we like how it turned out.
So do we.
No, it's been delicious, and our chefs are really enjoying it. We just got a whole big palette delivery, so we're really excited to have it available in the New York area. Well, actually, around the country.
Well, it is. It can always be eaten in Mama Fuko Sambar. It can also be eaten at Employees Only and at the Grill. Which is the old Four Seasons.
Correct. And then I know you guys work with Farmstead out in the Napa Valley.
Yes.
And a whole number of restaurants.
Mm-hmm. Chefs, and throughout the South.
Yeah, exactly. Chefs are always asking for it. And as we were discussing, you do the aging, you make it perfect, and then they're ready to slice it.
So what's new? What's on, besides needing a lot more Suriano?
Well, we're working on this dry cured lamb. Which, again, right now the confusion is with USDA. Hopefully we can convince them that it's safe. And
how good is it? Is it fantastic?
If you like lamb as a dry-cured product, it's unique, it's different. I like the flavor profile.
How long do you smoke it the same way? Sorry.
Yeah. I mean, we cure it. It's a much smaller piece, so we don't have to age it as long to get that fermented taste.
Bone in?
Boneless.
Mm-hmm. You age it boneless or you age it bone in?
We age it boneless.
Okay.
Aging it with a bone in when your yields are just terrible. So it helped keep the cost down. Lamb's expensive anyway. So sure.
What breeds of lamb?
Tunis.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
That's awesome. And those come from a local farmer?
Right.
Or?
Craig Rogers.
He's a famous lamb guy in the East Coast.
Yeah. Supposedly these sheep are direct descendants of some sheep that Thomas Jefferson had.
Yeah, the Tunis is something we work with at Heritage, and that's awesome. When can we taste it? How long does it have to hang?
Depends on the USDA. We're still trying to convince them that it's safe. We've done 5 batches so far. Every one of them has come back testing perfect, but it's still not enough to make.
And
the
in
USDA
your batches,
happy.
How long are you hanging? And how long are you smoking?
About 5 to 6 months age. Such a small piece, it doesn't need as much as a regular Suriano.
Because a lamb leg only starts at maybe 8 or 9 pounds.
Right, and boneless is maybe 5 pounds off of that.
All right, well, when you get approval, which we know where you're going to, I have a good feeling we would like to taste some on the air.
And
just to make everybody
we're also
jealous.
Working with some a guy in Texas that's raising some Barrico pigs.
Very good tasting pig.
That we'll have the results of that in another, I don't know, 14 or 15 months. Of course, we're always glad to see the Berkshires and the Red Wattles from Heritage. They still perform well. Nice marbling fat content.
Thank God. Well, you're our biggest buyer of hams by far. So the Tunis breed, by the way, goes back 3,000 years. The history of it, we sell it on our website. So that's why our tagline is Heritage Foods, hoofing it since 3,000 B.C., We were essentially founded in 3000 BC when the Tunis was invented. Well, Sam, we're big fans. You were one of the first sponsors of the radio station. You were basically a founder of Heritage because we were going bankrupt until you came along 12 years ago. So thank you so much for spending time with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks,
and,
Donna.
Stick around.
Yeah, we love you, Donna.
We love you, Donna. Patrick. We love you, Eric. And stick around.
We love you, Eric.
Angie, thank you as always for a great show. Stick around for a taste of the past, and we will see you guys next week. Have a good Thursday.
Right on.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content,
And to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the food world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thank you for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Alweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.